listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Good evening and welcome to Aloud at Central Library. Our standbys are getting seated. I'm glad to see. I'm Louise Steinman, the program director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which makes all of these free Aloud programs possible. Welcome to the second 2010 event of Aloud, and we have some wonderful events coming up, so I hope you'll grab a copy of our brochure out in the lobby. If you enjoy programs like this one come often, if you already are a Library Foundation member, associate, I want to thank you very much. And if you're not, we have a donation jar in the lobby, and we also have a membership table with some great incentives tonight, so do check it out. Dr. Atul Gawande knows how to tell a story. That's been clear to anyone reading his gripping pieces in The New Yorker over the years. From the first sentence of his new book, The Checklist Manifesto, Gawande pulls you in. Emergency room, San Francisco. A man comes in with a stab wound. The team is mobilized, the head-to-toe examination, the monitoring of consciousness, the fluids by IV. It's a cliffhanger, a high-risk situation fraught with danger. The patient does survive, but there's one thing that would have made the anecdote less hair-raising, and it's a strategy that doesn't come from medicine at all. In The Checklist, Gawande discovered a mighty idea that has the potential to transform medicine and many other fields where complexity has actually outstripped the ability of an individual to get things right. Atul Gawande became a staff writer at The New Yorker in 1998. Also a surgeon, he completed his surgical residency at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston in 2003 and joined the faculty as a general and endocrine surgeon. He's also an associate professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School, an associate professor in the Department of Health Policy and Management. This is going to be an introduction with many degrees in it. He has published research studies in areas ranging from surgical technique to U.S. military care for the wounded and error and performance in medicine. He is the director of the World Health Organization's global campaign to reduce surgical deaths and complications. His two previous books are Complications, A Surgeon's Notes on an Imperfect Science, and Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance. And in 2006, he received the MacArthur Award in recognition of his research and writing. In conversation with Dr. Gawande tonight, we are very honored to have as interlocutor Dana Goldman, one of the country's top experts in healthcare economics. So you will all want to take advantage of these two being here for the Q&A. Dr. Goldman is a professor and the Norman Topping Chair in Medicine and Public Policy at USC. Until recently, he held RAND's Distinguished Chair in Health Economics and directed RAND's program in Economics, Finance, and Organization. He's also an adjunct professor of health services and radiology at UCLA. His work is influential in both academic and policy circles, and he is the author of over 100 articles and book chapters, including articles in some of the most prestigious medical, economic, health policy, and statistics journals. I know that our guests will have much to talk about tonight, and in view of everything we've been hearing and going through in the past few months, years with healthcare reform, I know you'll have a lot of questions to ask. After their conversation, we will take questions from the audience. We will circulate a microphone so that we can all hear your question, and also because we do record for podcasts. So wait until it comes to you. And after the program, Dr. Gawande will be signing his book in the lobby. Again, please visit our membership table. And now please join me in welcoming Dana Goldman and Atul Gawande to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello.
I want to begin with just a note that as an economist talking to a doctor, I know you have all the sympathy of the audience. So I have to be very careful about that. But the one bone I have to pick with you is that your book almost got me arrested. And the reason why is I was reading it, and it's a rather riveting introduction, and I found myself muttering, oh, my God, oh, my God. The problem was I was on the tarmac at the time. And when I looked up, we were towards the runway, everyone was pointing to me and saying things, and I thought I was about to experience one of those TSA moments. So but it was good because I held up your book and showed it to the rest of the people, and everyone said, oh, we understand. So I thought you might share a little bit about some of those moments that you were able to capture so well in the book.
Well, in trying to tell stories about our policy and thinking in medicine, it one of the things that's eluded me, in a funny way, I start right off with a jab to The Economist, that our discussion, especially over the last year, has been so dominated by the policy and insurance and economic questions that we forget these are fundamentally clinical moments that are at stake here. These are medical, life-threatening, often issues. And so the kinds of situations that bring it home for me are ones, and one in particular that stuck in my mind and I've been thinking about for a long time was an episode that started with just reading a surgery report on how to save a drowning child. It came out of an Austrian hospital in 1999, and it was where they outlined many of the steps that we recognize are the ones we need to follow when somebody drowns. It involved a 3-year-old girl who had fallen into an icy fish pond. The parents dove in, and they could not find her. It was 30 minutes before they were able to find her on the pond bottom, pull her to the surface, get her to the shore, and of course she wasn't breathing. They called the emergency services line. They were taught over the phone how to do CPR. 8 minutes later, the ambulance arrives, and you get the first vital signs on the scene. Her temperature was 66 degrees. Her pulse was absent. She was not breathing, and her pupils were dilated and didn't react to light, which meant that her brain was gone. Then the article outlined what happened at that point. Helicopter to nearest hospital, bypass the emergency room, go into the operating room, put the child on cardiopulmonary bypass, which involves having to cut down over the groin and plug inflow and outflow lines into the femoral artery and vein, prime a pump, get that machine going. An hour and a half has passed since she's last breathed. They warm up her body 10 degrees, and then her heart starts to beat. So they go further, try to get her breathing through her lungs, but it's too full of pond water and debris to manage, so they bring in an artificial lung, an extracorporeal membrane oxygenator, where they now have to open her chest, plug the inflow and outflow lines directly into the right atrium of the heart and the aorta, get this machine up and going, take the other one out, pull a sterile drape over her open chest, get her to the ICU, 48 hours of medications and suctioning out her lungs, and then her lungs come back. And then the steps for getting the liver back, and then the kidneys, one right after the other. The last thing was her brain, which was swollen up against the limits of her skull when they finally were safely able to get her a CT scan. The neurosurgeons drilled a hole in her skull to relieve the pressure and place a pressure probe inside that guided them towards how to dial their medications and fluids to lower the pressure in the brain. And then after a week, she woke up. First, her pupils dilated, began to react to light, and then she began to breathe, and then she was just there. A week later, she went home. She was paralyzed. It wasn't over. She was paralyzed on the right side of her body, couldn't speak. Her speech was slurred, and so they had occupational therapy and physical therapy they outlined in the article. But 2 years later, after all of that, and that was weekly intensive work, 2 years later, the neuropsychological testing she was brought back to the hospital for that, and it showed she was completely back to normal. What struck me about this story, and I tell it early in the book, is that what it makes us realize is, first of all, how much we've accomplished through science and the fact that we could bring someone back from being without oxygen that long. But the second was just how intensely much is involved, how extraordinarily complicated. This was not like Grey's Anatomy. No, this wasn't a few chest compressions, she'll come coughing and sputtering back to life. This was dozens, hundreds of people having to execute steps one right after the other without anybody messing up. Someone didn't even wash their hands, get an infection under the drape, it would have been over. And what we're struggling with now in both the cost and the quality is how we manage this kind of complexity, this kind of delivery where we're having trouble making pneumonia care go right, making cardiac care. And that's because it looks something like this with lots of people and teams and steps that we're having trouble make go right.
Oh, my God. Well, I think this leads into the first question that I think is on my mind and maybe some others, which is, why are you writing about checklists?
I asked myself the same thing when I started writing this book about a year ago. It happened out of a project that my team started on. We had an assignment from the World Health Organization to try to work on a problem that was expanding worldwide, which was how to reduce deaths in surgery. As the economies of the world have improved, people are living longer. That's changed the kinds of disease that people face. Even in poor parts of the world, respiratory and diarrheal illness are being replaced by cardiac disease as the number one killer. Road traffic accidents are in the top five. Cancers in the top 10 in places like India, China, Vietnam, the Middle East. And the result is an explosion in surgery worldwide. We're up to 250 million major operations a year, one for every 25 human beings. It's surpassed the number of child deliveries, but with death rates 10 to 100 times higher. In the U.S., we have 150,000 deaths a year now following surgery, with at least half we recognize to be avoidable. We have the knowledge, but we're having trouble making it happen. And so we embarked on a project to try to find ways to reduce this. And our usual tactics were not working. Have people specialize and train longer and longer and longer. You couldn't have people more highly skilled, more highly trained than we have now in history. Nor could you have people working harder. So that's not going to work, making them work more. The other options were increasing the amounts of technology, and yet we're finding we're running into complexities created by technology rather than simplified. And what we found when we started looking around in other industries, aviation, how they build skyscrapers, is they used one other tool, which we weren't using as clinical experts, as doctors, and that was checklists. And so we began to try that idea in our own world and found we were, it was hard for people to accept. Pull out a checklist in the operating room before you get started, doctor. And yes, the nurse is going to stop you if you don't complete it. But we designed one with the help of Boeing, actually, to help manage how you deal under stress, chaos, complexity, and found we were able to design a checklist that focused on making the team more effective. Make sure antibiotics get in, make sure blood gets in if it's needed before the incision's made, that you have everything ready. But then also does everybody in the room know each other's name before you start? Has everybody had a chance to raise whether they have any concerns before you proceed? A few scripted steps that had much more to do with preparing teams to handle complexity than to just make a recipe for every single thing they were supposed to do, and implementing it in 8 hospitals around the world, ranging from Seattle, London, Toronto, Auckland, to rural Tanzania, Amman, Jordan, the Philippines, New Delhi. After 8,000 patients, we found that in these 8 hospitals, every single hospital had a reduction in complications. The average reduction was 36%. with 8,000 patients, we had 27 fewer deaths in the group that got checklists, which was a 50% reduction in deaths. All of these results statistically significant. And that's when I started writing about it, because there was something interesting going on in both our having taken so long to embrace an idea like this, and in still the ongoing resistance to spreading it to other fields within medicine.
And the evidence is remarkably compelling, and you cite it in the book. I want to try to think about the broader society and what message it has. So it works in aviation, and it works in construction, and it seems to be working in medicine. But there are lots of places where teamwork is important. But we know from experience that you need to have one leader who can make quick decisions and take charge at crucial moments. In Los Angeles, that's Kobe Bryant. how does that play out in the operating room? And is there a tension between teamwork and leadership when you're talking about life and death?
Yes, and the role of leadership shifts in an operating room. You have half a dozen people, and there are moments in time when the key steps in care and the main threats are ones in which I have to really take the lead for the team to move forward and make the case go as well as possible. But then there are other moments where the key problems are the patient's medical issues and having them safely anesthetized. And I have to be willing to be led by the anesthesiologist and what they consider the needs. You know, one of the fascinating things to me is that we walk out of these cases, it's gone well, you feel like it's been this symphony of roles that have been shifting among one another, like you've been the pit crew that day. and then you go out to talk to the family, and they say, thank you for saving my husband. and you feel a little bit like a fraud when you know that it's been this whole group of people that's made it happen. And we actually have a hard time as a country, I think, in being willing to give credit to teams for what they can pull off. We want to put it on one person. And that role of leadership, I think, is important. We have to understand, as part of the medical world now, how do you lead entire teams that can organize a continuum of care for patients? And then also, how do you, as a doctor, become a team mate, someone willing to follow the lead of other people?
And so how has the medical community and the surgical community in particular taken to your hypothesis?
Very quietly. That's why I'm writing the book now. it's been a mix, actually. There's been... It's a straightforward thing to incorporate. It's not as straightforward as you think, because using the checklist is not just about dropping a piece of paper off in a bunch of operating rooms around the world for people to put tick boxes on. It's about a culture. It has a set of values underneath it that require people to embrace teamwork and to make sure that the system's ready to have people prepared. But we've now... have 20 countries around the world that are implementing it as a national standard. The United Kingdom achieved implementation in all of its hospitals at the end of last year. France did as well. We're at about 20% of our hospitals, and there's an interesting correlation between systems that have universal coverage and the ability to have this come into practice. But and that willingness, though, that people have had to start giving it a try and see how to make it work belies something which I think is still a fundamental underlying resistance, which is this is not about, hey, Gawande made this checklist and now we got to use it. Oh, my God, we'll use it because someone will get mad at us if we don't. That misses the point. We have enormous numbers of high-risk, high-failure areas in what we do in medicine and in many other professions, but medicine's emblematic. You have lives on the line. And if this works in surgery, it really, and that's also, there's work by Peter Pronovost from Johns Hopkins. It's really been pioneering and trying it in some areas of intensive care medicine. But it leads you to say, why aren't we doing this as a way of thinking of ourselves in everything we do that's high risk, high failure? The emergency room when you have a drug overdose or a chest pain patient. We know 50% of only less than 50% of patients get timely cardiac treatment when they have a heart attack. That is, we know you should have a balloon gotten into that artery and opened it up within 90 minutes of arrival in an emergency room if you're having a heart attack, and less than 50% get it. And our usual approach is, you know, yell at people. Why aren't you getting those? Why aren't you getting people down there to the cath lab? Or say, well, we need to specialize more, give them more training, when most of the places that have achieved it have been starting to grasp that what you need is this kind of very smart checklists in place that help teams be more successful. So my sense of it is there is resistance to beginning to see ourselves this way and recognize these opportunities and actually invent these checks for ourselves, reach for it just as readily as we would reach for our stethoscope.
Right, and I think you say it quite eloquently when you say you want people to make sure to get the stupid stuff right, and I think that's right. Now, you call for some sort of change. In the aircraft industry, we have the National Transportation Safety Board, which is designed to investigate errors and make sure they don't happen again. We don't have that in medicine, as you point out. How much of that is due to the ethos of medicine, and how much of that do you think is due to the litigious climate and the fear of being sued?
Yeah, it's both, but that same litigious climate has been there in the aviation world. And what's interesting is that they embraced the humility of recognizing that they had failures and were having them recurrently, and embraced the idea of having an independent National Transportation Safety Board that would swoop in, independently investigate accidents, find the lessons, and make them public. If we had a series of if we had an independent board that could go into hospitals and doctors' offices to investigate why infections are spreading or why cardiac patients only 40% get the appropriate care, or why 60% of pneumonia patients are missing the appropriate care, we would have an outcry. You would have people in the medical world up in arms. And yet we've been doing this in the aviation world for 50 years. Part of it was they tackled the litigiousness issue. That is, being able to air where the problems are meant that you had to be able to let people explain the ways in which they failed. In the aviation world, you get what they call, in the common parlance, I don't think they actually have this in the law, but it's a get-out-of-jail-free card is what the pilots call it, meaning that if you file a report indicating that an error was made immediately after it has occurred, then there's actually a little ticket that you save for yourself that is your get-out-of-jail-free card. You can't be sued directly for it. The airline bears the responsibility, the enterprise. And there's a sense in which we've lost that, or we've not embraced that kind of chance, that that sense that we could do something very similar.
And is there anything like that in the health reform bill?
Yeah, there's not. of all the things that we have recognized that we can do to improve quality and lower costs in ways that drive us towards better organized medicine for the needs that patients have, there are provisions in the health reform bill to start changing the incentives of physicians and try to move us away from fragmented fee-for-service payment that rewards us for quantity rather than quality. There's measurement and transparency about quality. There's requirements the doctors actually post their prices. almost everything that economists and clinicians have recommended that we consider is in the bill in one form or another as a pilot or an experimental program for us to test out and see how it does, except malpractice reform. I've been an advocate of embracing something like a no-fault system, like the National Vaccine Compensation Fund, when vaccine manufacturers were facing so much litigiousness they were pulling out of the industry. A 75-cent per vaccine fee has been tacked on, which goes into a fund, and families who are injured by vaccines can get compensation much more quickly than they could through the legal system. And furthermore, that information is all public and has allowed better investigations and understanding of the patterns of vaccine failures. And more families who are injured are actually able to be compensated through that system. And it's freer of the blame game, much more focused on how do we make that system better over time. That system's not perfect, but it is by comparison a market improvement over where we are. But we're so caught up in the politics of it. The Republicans only want to focus on putting caps on what people can receive in the court system, and the Democrats are focused on making sure you have access to the courts with no room for discussion of what we might need really in the middle.
That's right. And actually, if you look at the rates of development of vaccines after this fund was put in place, they went up quite a bit. So
yeah,
the world
if I'm
is better
correct,
off.
You've done most of the research for us on how this
you.
Works.
Thank you. Maybe we'll switch places next year. One of the things that strikes me about surgery, and it comes through in your book, is that, and in some places it sounds like the surgeon marches into the OR and the patient's lying there and they're covered by a drape and the surgeon goes right to the part of the body where they have to make a change. And in some ways that's consistent with the analogy you draw with the aircraft industry, where you've got a steel and some skin there and you got to go there and solve it. But in fact, healthcare has a lot to do with, there is a role for the patient. And in some ways, there's an assumption, if you will, that when we see low rates of quality of care, it's that the healthcare system will do this to us and the patient is passive. Could you talk a little bit about that and the role of the patient?
Yeah, we've been slow to recognize the ways in which the patient is a crucial part of the team. One of the projects I'm working on now is a World Health Organization Safe Childbirth Checklist. And as we've focused on where are the killers across the period of childbirth, a lot of it are things that nurses and doctors need to be able to do. But we found there were leverage points where the patient could help enormously. For example, one of the key vulnerable moments, especially in poor countries, but you see it in rich places as well, is the first couple days after the mother takes the baby home. There will be a lot of times when the baby won't be able to feed well, won't be able to latch onto the breast, and then if the dehydration that can result isn't recognized, the baby's not feeding for a couple of days, the mother may have a dead baby on her hands or bring the baby too late to be saved. We realized that we needed a patient checklist. So we're devising as part of our package here a checklist that patients can use before they leave the hospital or the birthing facility to make sure that they've been adequately prepared. So one of the checks on there is have you been explained what the danger signs are for a child that should lead you to bring the baby back? And we're now in the process of trying to test those kinds. I'll give you one other example. In the intensive care unit world, we've learned that we can decrease pneumonias if we have a package of things which include having the patient's bed be elevated, the head of the bed up about 30 to 45 degrees. And we have checks now that nurses in some places use to check every 2 to 3 hours and make sure the head of the bed is in the right position. But we've only gotten to 80 or 90% adherence to being able to follow it. People get distracted. It's an intense environment. It's the intensive care unit. And people are focused on many things. But when they asked the patient's families, could you help us? And if you notice the bed is down, just let us know. Oh, and by the way, we don't mind if you also tell us if we haven't washed our hands. Only in those circumstances did they get to 100%. Only when they recognized that the patients and families were the people who cared the most about what would happen here, and we could equip you to help us get better results all the way around.
Right, and I know from personal experience, I travel a lot, and I used to always forget things, so I made my checklist of all the things I should bring. And after a while, I didn't need my checklist anymore because I went through a routine. And in healthcare, one of the interesting findings is that if you look even at surgery, places that have higher volume, they more patients, they have better outcomes. And how much of this is training people to do the right process? And after a while, maybe the checklist isn't even needed anymore.
Yeah, I'm not sure you get at a certain level of complexity, your brain just is not going to hold it in because even with routine, I was fascinated to visit a great restaurant in our hometown and in Boston called Rialto with a chef who's nationally known named Jody Adams. She let me come into the kitchen and see how she puts it all together. And the fascinating thing to me is here's this incredibly creative cook. Who has this amazing set of techniques, and when you watch on television, you see all their technique. But what you don't see is that every time she cooks something, she still uses a recipe. It's the 300th time she's made lobster americaine, and she says, that's the moment when I most need to have the recipe because that's the moment when I'll forget a crucial ingredient. But that said, a lot of what we're struggling to do is to learn how to bring that high volume set of outcomes that come from experience and working out the kinks to places that may not be high volume. Because in America, it's in community hospitals where people get most of their care. And you can't have everybody going to the handful of places that have this tremendous experience. So it's about the process of bringing high volume, high quality results to low volume places that may not have been achieving that quality. And we've assumed it's not transferable, that you can't get there. But the evidence in some areas, and I think it's also coming through in this, is that we can pull what seemed like a hugely wide bell curve of performance and begin pulling it together.
We want to push it to the right.
Yes.
You talk about, I think it's complex versus complicated, and I think that's a very important analogy. Doctors, a lot of what you argue that what doctors are doing is very, very complicated, and maybe you'll talk a little bit about make that distinction. But a lot of what they do also is very routine, that a lot of the cases, at least on the outpatient side, it's check the blood pressure, check the blood sugar, write the prescriptions. Will there come a day, for example, when some of this will be replaced by machines? Because machines don't miss those checkpoints.
Yeah, the distinction here is something that complexity theorists point out, which is they divide the kinds of problems that people try to solve into the simple, the complicated, and the complex. And the simple are things like baking a cake out of a box. You can have a recipe, and if you just follow the steps, it's fairly routine and reliable, and you'll get a great cake every time. A complicated problem is something like putting a rocket on the moon. This is not something you can easily reduce to a recipe, even though parts of it might be able to be in a recipe, but you have areas where you have unpredictable next steps and what might need to follow. You have specialists required for portions of it and coordination that has to come together. And we imagine that the world of checks and doesn't fit there. And then you get the truly complex, a problem like raising a child. You can do great at raising one child, and it has nothing to do with how you'll do with the next one.
I need a machine to raise my child.
Yes. Experience that doesn't carry over, and having expertise doesn't, you know, amount to necessarily much. But we do know that there are people we recognize as being better parents than others. So it's not that it's without grasp. And a lot of the work that I tried to get into has been about how you prepare people for handling the complicated and the complex more successfully, which can include, in ways, checklists to a surprising extent. But the core idea he's getting at is there is this large chunk of work that undergirds what we do where there are clear things that have to be done. That when you have a patient coming to surgery, you always have to make sure blood's available if they're a high blood loss risk, that you always have to make sure that you've checked that they're safe, you've looked in their mouth, and they're safe to put to sleep under anesthesia and so on. And the world does divide up in those ways, and those are many of the steps that you can almost automate. And so I visited Microsoft recently, and they showed a computer program that's their early prototype in development for communicating with patients about simple problems for which there are algorithms, and that you could almost self-medicate, that you could, for common problems for which, you know, an antibiotic prescription may be the routine first step unless it reaches a certain level of complexity. Their argument is we will very soon reach the point where the sensible thing to do is go to the internet doctor and let it prescribe you the medication.
Right. Actually, I'd like to ask you some questions about health reform, if I might.
Yeah.
And actually, this will key off one comment you made, which is in the United Kingdom, they have a universal healthcare system, and that makes it easier to implement these types of checklists. And so is this something that government can just legislate? And what is the role of regulation here for improving outcomes in healthcare?
Our big trouble is that we want the freedom and flexibility of local systems to develop innovatively and in ways that are responsive to our needs. And we're a big country, and we fear having things be run from Washington in ways that I think are appropriate. When we're talking about hundreds of thousands of individual local entities required to deliver on what are 6,000 drugs, 4,000 medical and surgical procedures that have been discovered and we want to make available to people as well as possible. But the tensions are over what the right level of regulation should be. On one level, leaving it entirely to whatever develops has been unacceptable because of the levels of harm that we've seen, and providing some regulation has been crucial for bringing up the safety and consistency of hospitals, making nursing homes no longer fire traps, but at the same time, trying to run them and control them from afar has meant in places that have tried to do it, long waiting lines, unresponsive change as new technologies come on board. So what we have been trying to do is walk the middle way. And I'm fascinated by the airline analogy because the FAA does regulate very carefully the airline world, but it doesn't run the airline world. They insist, for example, that every airline, every pilot in a commercial world uses a checklist for the key high-risk things they do. They don't tell them what that checklist should look like. Boeing and Airbus make their checklists, give it to the airlines, and the airlines don't even have to follow them. The airlines most commonly change them and turn them into what they find is most useful in their environment to make it work locally. And they work with their pilots to say, here's what we want to do. One of the fascinating things to me is that that I learned from spending some time up in Seattle at Boeing was that among the most contentious issues when two airlines merge is the fight between the pilots' unions over which checklists they're going to use. Because they feel they invented the ones that they have made. And there's a truth to this that we could embrace in the medical world, the expectation that we have these standards and abilities to make our organizations work well, but also the expectation that we are inventing and changing and constantly improving these kinds of techniques. And so embracing them because we have to, but then inventing and discovering and making them ourselves.
Right, so we definitely walk a tightrope. And actually, the only thing I've ever seen Michael Moore, who made the movie Sicko, and Sarah Palin agree on is that the government shouldn't say no to anyone. So we only have we're going to open it up to questions in a few minutes. I have one more thing. I tried to get an appointment with my doctor the other day, and I was told I'd have to wait till March. And with health reform pending, I see that we're going to have 30 million newly insured. And my doctor tells me I don't have any capacity to do this. And so I'm wondering, is the healthcare system going to be able to absorb all this? And how will it change? As an economist, we say prices will go up. But I thought I'd hear your response.
Yeah. We've seen this happening in Massachusetts. 2 years ago, we adopted a system that looks a lot like the health reform that we're contemplating now. And the fascinating thing is that it came on board and people almost didn't notice it. I talked to some of my fellow colleagues about what they think about the Obama health reform plan, and they say it'll ruin everything. They're going to be changing the whole insurance system. And I say, but we adopted this plan 2 years ago. And they'd say, we did. The fascinating thing is that we went from a situation where in my practice 15% of my patients were uninsured. I'm a primarily cancer surgeon, and we would spend time having to figure out how do we get them chemotherapy, how do we get them radiation, even when you agree to provide your services for free. And it was an enormous struggle, and then suddenly it disappeared, and all my patients were paying patients. And also we weren't having these struggles. And yet we haven't recognized the revolution that has happened in our own place, except in one way. It has been harder for those patients to find primary care. Primary care was, we have too few physicians going into primary care, into fields like pediatrics and internal medicine. And those offices have found their panels filling up even faster now that there are people who have insurance who didn't have access to their offices before. It is very similar to what happened in the UK when they brought on a universal coverage system in 1947, I believe it was. Or was it 46? Are you a historian? The striking thing was it included dental and vision. Hundreds of thousands of people who had never had glasses before were lining up for optometrists, and there weren't nearly enough to go around. Same with dentistry, and the famous jokes about the British and the teeth have persisted for a long time since. But the striking thing is that they did eventually close those gaps, but it took time. There was a transition. It's not like you have people waiting in the wings expecting health reform to come online. And it forces a certain kind of innovation as well. Because I'm not as alarmed about 30 or 40 million people getting access to care who didn't have it before as I am about the aging of the population. We think that is a significant jump. In the next 15 years, we will double the number of people who are over the age of 65. That's the population at highest risk of cancers like breast cancer and colon cancer, for example. And in my field of cancer care, what we're asking ourselves is in a world where the medical workforce is going to stay about the same size, how are we going to cope with essentially a doubling of the number of cases that we are dealing with in the cancer world and in other worlds? And the answer is going to be that we have to be smarter about how we take care of folks. We have to be able to realize that there is huge amounts of time wasted in our system where we spend actually very little of our time actually sitting down and talking to patients, spending time thinking with them and sorting through the issues that need to be spent. We've undervalued that time and overvalued the time spent in CT scanners or getting operations without recognizing that we're often over-treating people and subjecting people to these kinds of interventions that are not only costly but can be harmful. And so understanding what's required at the front lines to get there is why I've started to write about such things as tools as checklists, because if we are to be able to handle this and do it in a way that makes people feel that their quality of care is actually improving over time while we're doing better with costs. It's only going to be by thinking about these frontline steps, the checks that must be in place to make things go smoothly.
That's an excellent point. I think what I'd like to do is open it up to the audience. And if you have questions right here, there's a speak into the microphone. Try to keep the question relatively brief.
As a lawyer, I was wondering to what extent you think that malpractice suits could have a role in influencing doctors' behaviors, such as using a checklist or having or falling below the standard of care, and more intriguingly, being sued because you gave too much care that wasn't necessary, that was expensive, and that was ultimately harmful.
Yeah, there are lawsuits that challenge, when you have a severe injury to a patient, left them permanently disabled, and then there's a question whether the operation was even indicated in the first place. That, of course, comes up in lawsuits as a source of challenge and a basis for people to make cases. I think there's an interesting tension with the malpractice system. It is a form of accountability, holding our feet to the fire. It can be a random scattershot system, though. Only 1% of patients who are actually harmed get access to the system through it. I in my last book, Better, I go into detail. Time with a malpractice lawyer, a plaintiff's lawyer who sues folks, who was willing to have me spend a month or so with him and understand how his work really worked. And he would describe to me about how he'd turned down 49 out of 50 people who called in because they weren't good clients for him. If they don't speak English, not going to be sympathetic enough in front of juries in most instances. If they are smokers, that this may, even though their injury may be related to something different. So as we walked through and saw the processes, you began to understand why it's only a tiny subset who are considered sympathetic enough to make it through the system. 2/3 of them still lose. It's 5 to 7 years before there's a payoff. And still much of the dollars don't go to help them, but into the court costs and legal costs and the lawyers. The flip side is I've also done the studies of the kinds of cases, and that you do have not as many frivolous cases as doctors like to claim, where we think it's all frivolous cases, but about 1/3 where you could not find a injury that actually was caused by error or negligence, but were the consequences of complications due to the risks of care. And so it's made for a system that is one of the few that hold our feet to the fire in the absence of what they have in the aviation world, like a National Transportation Safety Board to investigate accidents and provide lessons. I think that one of the fascinating things to me that can emerge from reform is that as we become more transparent about our results, begin working more on raising the quality issues and the safety matters, and recognizing the tools we need to get forward, we may find over the next half decade or decade that the public is more ready to see the opportunity to change that system as well.
Right down here. Either one.
Okay, she's next. Are we graduating enough doctors, to handle, the increased medical loads that you're referring to in terms of the aging, population? And if we're not graduating enough, what do you suggest be done, to meet that need?
Well, it feels like a double-edged sword to me. We have already close to 1 million physicians in the country. The portion of the country that works in healthcare is about 10 to 11%. And then if you include the indirect people working in healthcare, serving as marketing people and so on, you're up to close to 20%. So, you know, where will we need to have 30% of the country working in healthcare to take care of everybody? There's a great Christmas card I got from Uwe Reinhardt, the economist, in which he follows out the trend line on growth and GDP and employment in healthcare until it's 99% of the economy and occupation by people working in healthcare. And then on the inside, you see what it looks like, which is three people in the same bed taking care of each other. So in the short run, it feels like, well, we need more surgeons, we need more more primary care, we need more of everybody, that we all seem to feel that we've got inadequate loads. But it's the reflection of a system that actually is full of terrible inefficiencies, waste that we see around every corner. We worked with a community recently, Cedar Rapids, where they recognized that they had done 52,000 abdominal CT scans for their population of 300,000, 52,000 CT scans of any kind for a population of 300,000 people in a year. Now, if you follow the trend lines and you continue to increase CT scans for your population by 10% a year, well then, yeah, you're short of radiologists. But if you ask, should we be doing this many CT scans? The physicians were actually embarrassed to realize just how many they had done. They looked at their head CT scans, for example, and found that out of 10,000 scans, fewer than a dozen actually had caught an abnormality, that many of them were outside of national guidelines, for example, for when you should get a scan to take care of a headache. Some of the arguments the physicians had made was that the malpractice system had forced them there. And yet we see communities where they're not doing nearly that many scans without having lawsuits, been able to be more organized and regimented, avoiding duplicate scans and others. We put actually a checklist in place for our ordering of CT scans and found we could reduce it in my own hospital by almost 20%. Without anybody feeling that we were rationing. Instead, it was rational care.
Hearing them. Can you?
I first want to say that I'm an Atul Gawande groupie, for what it's worth. But when the mammogram studies came out recently that suggested that maybe we shouldn't be having as many mammograms as we first thought, I got into fights with a lot of my friends for suggesting that maybe we shouldn't. And so the idea that it's counterintuitive to think we shouldn't be tested as often as we should, I just wonder what you thought about, what you think about that?
It's been such a fascinating discussion because in many ways the data that has driven this has been out there and it just has gotten more and more concrete. And essentially what the numbers tell us is something that is a value decision. In order to save one person at age 40 from breast cancer, we have to do about 2,000 mammograms, if I have the numbers right. And when you do 2,000 mammograms yearly, then you end up catching several hundred who have to come back for repeat mammograms because of questions or suspicions on there. And then you have somewhere in the range of 60 to 100 who end up with biopsies, or surgery for the sake of that one. And the judgment of this committee was that that when we tried to really value, were we with 2,000 scans needing to be done, that many extra biopsies and so on, was this worthwhile or not, that we were doing more harm than good. But it's a value judgment, and it's one for which in many ways each woman deserves to have a chance to try to think through, but this is clearly the gray zone. Another example is a similar controversy, the prostate tests, PSA. The data has come out now that we're doing these tests, and they're turning up a lot of men who may or may not have an issue in their prostate, but only 1 in 50 actually has a cancer that might have killed them. And so the result is that with the PSA test, It's leading to a high rate of prostatectomies, surgery to remove the prostate. And so for, so the basic number that you keep in your mind now is that with this test, you will have 47 men who will have their prostate removed for the sake of saving one of them. Right now, about 20 to 25% of those men will be left impotent or incontinent. So is it worth it doing that test? And there is only a value choice here. It is, in my judgment, not a test that I would take if that's the math that works out here.
Well, let me challenge you on that in the sense, if Medicare chose to just cover the least expensive option, it turns out it would save about $3 billion a year, which doesn't sound like a lot because healthcare spending has gotten so high, but there are a lot of areas where it could do that.
The least expensive option with prostate testing or with...
With prostate treatment, treatment of localized prostate cancer. And they could save $3 billion, but everyone says that it's not the role of the government to decide what treatment should be. Should Medicare, for example, cover anything if your doctor says you should get it?
Well, you know, it's really a question of is there, there's two things. One is there benefit? And even just reaching the point of saying that we shouldn't be providing, paying for therapies where there's clearly harm has been a controversial question. Medicare withdrew payment for physicians who leave sponges in their patients, and the hospital and the physician have to basically bear the costs of having made that mistake. And that alone has been controversial. And so reaching the point that we would agree that if you have three different therapies of which there are advantages and disadvantages, I'll give you an example, one that I had to personally deal with. Because my son has a cardiac condition that's required interventions over the years. He's 14 and now, and he's done unbelievably. But 2 months ago, had to have a cardiac stent put in for him. And they gave us a choice of three stents. They said, well, here's one, here's another, and here's a third, and here are the risks and benefits of these. Here's the newest one, and we don't quite know much about it, but we think it might be better for these reasons. I mean, the whole thing just gave me a headache, and I didn't know. I'm a surgeon who should be as familiar as possible. I didn't know how to choose among these three just on risk and benefit. And then if you'd have told me your insurer will pay for the least expensive one, but the most expensive one, you'd have to pay the difference out of pocket. All I would say to the surgeon is you tell me what the best you think is, and we'll figure out how to pay for this. When lives are on the line, even in the face of real uncertainty, it is hard to reduce it simply to a market choice. In many ways, we feel it is hard-hearted, and that is part of the dilemma for the economics of it. But I think we are a long way away from needing to say, we have to ration in order to save our health system, because when we see that we have communities, as I wrote about in The New Yorker, where you have two equal communities with equal rates of sickness and problems with the condition of patients coming in, but one costs twice as much as the other but gets worse results from it, we know we can gain a huge amount of benefit long before we're reaching the point of saying you can't have that stent unless you mortgage your house.
Some questions in the back, right there.
Dr. Gawande, I read a very good article you wrote in The New Yorker a couple of months ago called Cost Conundrum. I happen to be in healthcare. And an interesting part of that essay you wrote, you spoke about the mindset of physicians and what the incentive is, and sometimes the incentive about caring for the patient is lost. I work in a big institution and work with a lot of interns and residents, and I find that their biggest concern is paying their bills. And they get through medical school and they want to immediately go into specialized medicine because they couldn't imagine they could survive as a primary physician. And so don't you think that the whole mindset in America has to change about going into medicine and the passion for being a physician? Is it to take care of people or is it to make money? I'm just curious how you feel about this.
Yeah, I mean, I call it in the article the battle for the soul of medicine. And it's a battle going on not just community by community, but in each of our own souls. And you see the transformation in our medical students. I see them when they come in, and they have come in because they want to be people who play a helping role in the community and for patients. There are many other easier ways to go out there and make money. But by the time they finish their training, especially when they're carrying a couple hundred thousand dollars in debt, you see the calculus starting to change. They don't quite admit it to themselves, but by the end, you see a mix of having worked 4 intense years through medical school, reaching that point in your life where you're getting towards your late 20s, thinking about family and other things. You can see people thinking about using words like lifestyle, balance, not wanting to, and you start seeing options that they wouldn't have remotely talked about in the very beginning. Radiology, specialties that right now are highly remunerative. You don't see as many people interested in pediatrics, general internal medical practice. There's also more complicated reasons in there. We don't think and value in the medical world the people who are in those areas of primary care specialty as highly. We don't think of them as being the high prestige areas, and that perhaps reflects the money as well. But it all goes together in a harmful mix, being in debt, not having the prestige for these key areas. Probably one of the most important areas that we have need is in geriatrics, and we actually have a declining number of geriatricians trained in the country as we have a massively increasing number of people with geriatric needs. And that reflects changes where we need to change the monetary incentives. And my own profession in surgery has fought some of those changes. Although now we're starting to see the light, since one of the neglected areas is general surgery and taking care of emergency late night problems. People would rather become specialty surgeons, plastic surgeons, and others. And so the current bill includes general surgeons as part of the group, and that softened some of the specialty fights against redistributing the kinds of payments. But I think that cultural battle is really fundamental. The disparities are striking within medicine. It's really shocking, I think, where you'll have people in one specialty make 4 to 5 times as much as people in another specialty. I can understand that in some specialties people may have longer hours and have trained longer and may be more intense, but the difference is not 4 to 5 times.
Question over here.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mamta Singhvi, and I'm a young physician and an aspiring writer, and I just want to tell you how much you inspire us.
Thank you.
Thank you for eloquently answering that question, because that speaks, you know, to young people, interns who have just graduated. And based off that question, I wanted to ask you, as you've gone through your training and through your life, just with the fatigue, the inefficiency of the system, the limited resources, How have you managed to stay inspired to believe that this is a noble profession and to want to continue to help people?
When I went through medical school, I heard from many of the same people you hear from, physicians who would say if they could do it over again, they wouldn't do it. And I've never actually gotten that. I've never understood it. And I don't know what I do that makes it feel differently to me, but the people are fascinating. The stories that come in every day, every time you see someone. I think it may be influenced by having grown up in a small town as the son of a pediatrician and a urologist who really felt themselves part of the community by virtue of being doctors. They both became presidents of the local Rotary Club. They both would, you know, host dinners to have the firemen over. That sense of playing that role, that you understood yourself as a citizen, getting, and not just your narrow specialty, whether my dad was a urologist or my mother the pediatrician, that they saw themselves as part of the fabric of that community, I think is something that has been inculcated in me, is bred into me, and has made me feel that I'm very lucky to get to have this vantage point on the world, to see the drama of life and death, to take part in it, to be still what I feel is very well compensated. I have a nice house. and to be still regarded as people who are doing the best we can for good in the community, despite all the money issues and despite all the pressures. I think we have a lot to do to maintain that trust, to convince people we are, and convince ourselves that in that battle for our own souls, are we serving patients' needs or are we becoming businessmen, that we are on the right side of that ledger. The only ways that I'm able to do it is has been by just being curious about people's lives, and the writing has been probably one of the ways that I'm able to express it and sustain it. But different people find different ways that they're able to keep that going.
Well, you are a practicing surgeon. You do research. You teach. You raise two kids.
Three.
And my colleagues at Harvard tell me that you write between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m.
No, no, no. So. I get my sleep, by the way.
Two more questions. Okay. Right here in the black.
I had a quick question in terms of, I think, you know, your talk today really focused on the very high-tech end of medicine. But I think as we're starting to realize, we talk about the obesity epidemic, and in the neighborhoods where I work, Compton and South LA, it's a lot more about the social determinants of health. And when you look at people in the healthcare profession, traditionally that's just sort of either referred to the social worker or it's something that is not that they're traditionally trained to do. So how do you see medicine moving to address those problems, such as healthy access to healthy foods and healthy housing?
Let me just add one thing to that question. The life expectancy of an African American with 0 to 8 years of education is 14 years less than a white male with 13 plus years of education. So that 14-year gap is, how do we fill it?
Well, cover both, is from obesity to all of our racial disparities. we have struggled in the medical world with where our boundaries of responsibility are. And I'll give you one example. The Children's Hospital in Boston decided to do a project on how to deal with their asthmatic population and reduce admissions to the hospital, where you had all these overlaying issues of socioeconomics, racial disparities, and others. And you, in that project, you could almost see all of these tensions in our health system play out. Because first of all, they needed to break down the boundaries of the usual specialty divides. what they did was made a checklist for how to take care of asthma patients. And when you looked at the evidence of what was required, some of it was doing all the usual things you do in your office, but others were making calls between office appointments to the families at home to make sure that they had their supplies of their inhalers for their kids and that there weren't any trouble keeping their kids on their inhalers. Another was really far out of what we do, which is making sure that there was a home inspection for making sure they didn't have mold infestation or dust mites, which are turning out to be critical components driving severe asthma. By following through on this kind of checklist, and it required really persuading teams that they needed to include people that may not even be MDs or nurses to be part of making this work well, they were able to reduce their asthma admissions by more than 80%. Now, here's the second part. Guess what their number one source of revenue is? Asthma admissions are the number one source of revenue for children's hospitals. And expanding this program threatened their bottom line. Part of what is fundamentally important in my mind about reform is that there is no master switch for changing this problem overnight because we don't have the magic pull-it-off-the-shelf solution. But it provides what I think of as a toolkit. People keep talking about health reform as a first step. What it is in my mind much more is it's a toolkit. And in the kit are tools like allowing communities that begin to reorganize to pay their doctors and hospitals differently instead of fee-for-service so that you lose money by taking good care of the asthma patients. It is one in which you might receive a bundled payment for your asthma patients and then keep part of the savings by generating higher quality and lower cost care. It is really new for us, and we have lots of struggles over how to make that work in your community, in other communities. But the tools are there, and for the medical community and local community that grabs hold of it, it is these are the kinds of experiments that are going to make a huge difference over the next few years, and we'll learn from them and need to spread them. But when it comes to that question that you raised, this kind of work is key to moving us to not just aiming for generating more and more revenue and more quantity of care, but of actually improving the health and results for the community. The last thing I'll say about obesity, I don't know what we do about obesity. We have every single trial that is out there for what you do to help people lose weight. You find 2/3 of patients can lose weight for 6 months, whether it's the Atkins diet or exercise programs or community interventions. But 5 years later, people will be 95% back at their baseline weight or worse. And it reflects a struggle against our genetic inheritance. We were raised in, we developed our DNA in a time of scarcity of food. And so we learned to store it in our bodies. And now we're in a world of abundance of food. And I think the toolkit is not going to just be how do we coach patients, though we need to learn how to do that better and study it. I think it's also going to use the classic public health components that that has made us gradually more successful in smoking cessation, targeted public media, changing the way we pay for and provide food, having really moving food away from the places where it's most readily accessible. The one set of kinds of programs that are actually starting to blunt obesity, at least among children, are a panoply of things where the worst kinds of foods have been removed from the schools, changes in levels of exercise that are expected in the school system. But it's very hard to sustain. And we've got a long way to go on that end. We're ready to do amazing things with problems like asthma. We've got a longer way to go with obesity.
You didn't put in my favorite, which is coin-operated elevators. So, I think the last question over here.
Recognizing the fact that you said a checklist is more than just a list of things on a piece of
piece of paper. What do you recommend for people, to do if they're going to go into a hospital? I mean, are there, what things can one do, whether or not the hospital has a checklist, and can you find out if the hospital uses a checklist?
Yeah. On the simplest level, for surgery, we actually have a website, which is safesurge.org, where we have mapped the hospitals that have implemented the checklist. The second thing is that you can ask your doctor, do you use the World Health Organization Safe Surgery checklist in your operating room? That said, your decision about who you see for a surgeon is going to be a mix of how much experience do they have, what's their reputation, what's your experience with seeing them, how much confidence do you have, as well as, and this can be one of the factors that really come in. But I think being willing to press hospitals, and it's really at the hospital level that is the important one, writing to the president of the hospital, of your community hospital, and asking, do you have the checklist in place, and if not, why not, something that can make a difference. And then when you notice that things are falling through the cracks in other areas, whether it's HIV care, your care when you go to the doctor. Here's my last example here, knowing this is the last question. A friend of mine had a bad depression, went to see her doctor, got started on antidepressant, didn't work. They changed the antidepressants. They went through counseling, 3 years of just real struggle. And then they looked back and realized they hadn't checked her thyroid hormone level. All the guidelines tell you a handful of things that you should check every time a patient comes in with depression. She got her thyroid hormone. 3 weeks later, was almost instantly, you know, within 3 weeks, had her life back. But she lost 3 years because of it. And when we see a move like that, what we do is we just say, you know, fire that doctor, or, you know, we become furious about it. But what we have instead is a constructive remedy, which is we can use those lessons to say, why not adopt a checklist? Thank you.
I think on that.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.